Hello, my fellow geeks and nerds. Welcome to We Digress.
We Digress.
A podcast where we discuss games and fandoms of all kinds.
All kinds.
As well as clips from our group digressing in the middle of game instead of rolling dice.
Those bastards.
Hope you enjoy.
Hello, everybody, and apparently we've got a new show idea for this week. So instead of the regularly scheduled We Digress segment, which the host is sitting right over here in the living room.
All right, this is Darth Blasphemous here with you once again, and I have convinced Goblin here, since he has to take over from time to time, thanks to our real-life aggro, that he should start a show talking about gaming stuff on a semi-whim basis. I would like him to call it Goblin's Gaming Corner.
All right, so apparently this is the first inaugural launch episode of Goblin's Gaming Corner, and we're going to start off pretty big on this one. So if you are a GM or aspiring GM, even an old GM, who's got some weird questions in hand, hopefully we'll cover them this week. And if not, well, we're going to do more of the segment, apparently.
Oh, let me give you guys a quick preface. So We Digress, as I'm sure many of you hear in the intro, was supposed to be about us digressing in game. But that's become a bit harder in our regular game. Due to scheduling conflicts, hell, we hadn't gamed for over 3 weeks. God. So I've taken it upon myself to commandeer our off days, which will be an every other week thing, which will line up perfectly with our scheduled shooting, or recording, rather. And I've created a game where we can just have fun with it and digress and bullshit. It's just a for-fun campaign. Now, we'll cut out all the boring stuff like us rolling and stuff, unless it's really funny. But something to kind of weigh in to that is I'm first-time DMing here. I've only been playing for 2 years now, and that's between two systems. So this is...
This is me, as an elder GM slash gamer who's been doing it for...
My lifetime?
Yeah, your lifetime, pretty much. So I'm going to be answering questions for our new GM here that normally don't get asked or answered on most media forums. Of course, anybody can go on YouTube and look up a lot of really good...
Basically, you can go on YouTube and find a whole bunch of tutorials, run-throughs of how-tos. Everything from building a character to understanding your alignment. But we're more about the questions that kind of get pushed to the edge, or at least we haven't seen a lot of. Like, I'd love to do a review in Goblin's Gaming Corner about my new favorite class, which is the Occultist. More on that later, because I haven't seen much. Everyone's all about the Kineticist, which is cool, they're awesome, don't get me wrong. The Occultist, there's a lot I love about it. But this is kind of where we're just going to go over stuff that we think, well, usually I'll just have a question, but I think Goblin's going to come in with more of a, these are things no one really talks about. Like, this started all because I was inspired by your recording of talking about the evil alignment.
Well, the reason I did that recording is pretty much predominantly is these are topics that are not really covered. They're kind of taboo topics, if you will. Most GMs don't go into these realms too in-depth. And, you know, playing a evil character in a campaign is completely legitimate as long as it's approached by someone in a mature manner, not going full tilt 100% balls to the wall, Joker crazy. So in your game, he's already given me gratis to do it. I'm going to be playing a chaotic evil character. So somebody out there, granted it's a new GM, is going to meet my challenge that I'm going to make a chaotic evil character and not ruin his fucking game in the process. Actually, so far the background I'm making is rather intricate, even for a JFF game.
Yeah, and it's partially because when I was inspired from your talk about how to make and use an evil character, I just sat down and felt inspired to create a character. So, I made our liaison for this campaign, the guy who was in command, mainly so I don't have to shoehorn people too hard on where to go and what to do. I have a character, which I will run minimally, because he likes to be background. He doesn't like to get his hands dirty. His name, and I know there's going to be cringe for this, his name is Azuri Riss, the Elvish Bard. He plays the flute, so yes, he's an Elvish Piper. Yes, there's some for fun for this. I draw a lot from Magic the Gathering because it's most of what I know. So,
but once my evil comes to full fruition, the nation of Dolom and its Dolomite peoples shall feel my wrath for their war that has plunged itself into my halfling homeland.
Yes, don't worry, I'm probably going to bore you all with a long backstory on this before we get to the fun stuff of actually starting a YouTube channel with videos of us playing this game, because it'll be for fun, it might be entertaining.
And, of course, right now it's all preliminary, so the release schedule is not open yet. And one other thing I do want to note here, before we get too deep into the podcast, is I apologize straight up for all of the echo. We are actually recording at the old location, which is currently being cleaned out. So a lot of the stuff that would be in the background soaking up the vibrations of audio are not here.
But don't worry, new location is getting outfitted real good. And we'll have better audio quality for you here in about a month.
Thank the gods.
So, to begin, I'm running this as sort of a dungeon runner for the most part. It's where a lot of the big pieces lie. Because everyone's trying to collect these specific items. There are several adventuring parties out in a nation that was founded by adventurers in the eons past. Well, a little over 1,000 years. And, you know, when it comes to trying to look up ways to build a dungeon for the first time, because it is a major story piece here, for the first one at least, there were a lot of people that talked about, you know, there's a method, a rule of thumb, if you will, on you want to have 5 major room types in your dungeon. Kind of helped, but it was a 7-minute video. I go and find other videos that are like 1.5 hours long about dungeon creation, and I get a little lost and they're a little dry.
I would actually recommend, and I was going to add in this earlier, there's 2 specific GMs.
Mm-hmm.
They are tried and true. They got their merit badges on their sash and everything, GMs that I would look into. One of them is Matt Mercer, who has a deal on YouTube where he runs a bunch of people who are professional voice actors. It's really entertaining to see them. He is a great GM at keeping everybody on the ball. They hardly ever digress during game. They hardly goof off. Once game begins, they are on track all the way through from beginning to end with very little screwing around.
Geek and Sundry, right?
Geek and Sundry, yes.
I've watched a few. I actually started watching their deal. I got a little lost in the sauce because I missed a few weeks.
Yeah.
Or a few episodes, and I was like, all right, I can't keep up. I'm not going to back watch these.
For the more thespian player, for people who want to play more of the role in their games, there's this, I can't remember the name of it, but the dude is a South African guy.
Okay.
I thought he was British, but he's a South African guy. He's got a bunch of videos on there. And perhaps in the future, Goblin's Corner, I'll bring him up more fully into the light. But from GM to new starting GM, I'll show you a link to his videos. But everybody out there will find a video series or a GM out there that they can latch on to and take as a mentor, even if it's just YouTube videos. That will help him out. So I'm giving these two paradigms as a suggestion because Matt Mercer's game from Geek and Sundry is on the ball. It's very numerical. It's a lot of numbers.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bit of role in the role play, and that's ROLL. Mm-hmm. There's quite a bit of that. There's a lot of dice throwing going on. And the ROLE is a bit lighter, whereas the South American GM who's giving pro tips and hints, he's going more for the ROLE.
Mm-hmm.
With a little bit of the ROLL sprinkled on top. So they're kind of polar opposites in that way. But if you go with these two, you'll be able to find that nice bridge in between. Mm-hmm. And every GM, they're going to roll a different kind of game. Like, you as a new GM, starting off with a dungeon runner is great.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good start. It's very simple. You basically have everything written down beforehand. It's all on grid paper. And you have only pretty much marks on the map as to where the storyline goes. The players have gotten to this mark, we check that off, and you're playing a very linear game in that instance.
Yeah.
There's very little free roam, whereas the game that I'm running right now, you guys are just on the cusp. Once you're done with a couple more towns, it will be free roam, so it's going to be a lot more challenging for me because there's no more roadmap points.
Yeah.
So a dungeon game starting out, that's a great idea.
Well, the major part of this one is I wanted to fill in our time so we can get some dice rolling. Because we all know how, you know, a game dies. There starts to be scheduling conflicts. God forbid, as adults, we have real-life aggro to deal with. You know, and we've had that. People have gotten new jobs. People are getting changed in their location of their job. You know, stuff like that. So I wanted a way to just fill in the gap where I can sit down, put all my imagination and creativity into something that's useful And we can just pull this out whenever, and I'll have a dungeon ready. We can pick up where we left off.
Precisely.
And I figure as I get more into the groove, I can input more of these open area roaming things. Because we're all starting out level 7. I'm sure people out there are like, you're a new GM. You should always start your people at level 1. We're playing level 7 characters in Goblin's campaign right now. And I figured, let's start where everyone's very familiar. Because we've been playing this game for a while. And
almost 2 years now.
Well, no, this specific
game. Oh, this specific game, yeah, only about a year.
Not even a year, because we didn't start till August.
Oh, well.
Because July was
when my brother was here. It's been a while, and my mind is always in very weird places, so for you guys it may be less than a year, but for me it's been a decade, okay?
True.
One of the things that I wanted to go over, first off, and we mentioned this earlier in one of our previous conversations, and it feels good to bring it up now, is motivation.
Right.
And I brought up, you know, how revenge and betrayal are always good. Motivators get characters into active. Get them active. And, of course, you were like, oh, Q, are you being facetious? And I'm like, no, dude, I'm being legit. One of the ones that I've done over and over in a lot of different games is betrayal by a trusted NPC. And a lot of GMs will go over this one. You bring an NPC who is helpful, not overly helpful. Bring in a NPC who's helpful to the party, but not overly helpful, who does not seem overly threatening, and has definite traces of mortality to them. If the group gets attacked in the middle of the night, they're going to take an arrow or two.
Yeah.
Make sure that you show that they're a bit more frail than awesome. In fact, one thing you really don't want to, in a kind of a weird side divergent here of this, is bring in an NPC who just takes the light away from the PCs.
True.
You don't want a spotlight hog to be an NPC because that'll just piss players off. But roundabout back to where I was, the NPC who betrays the party, it doesn't matter how small it is. Once that NPC turns around and says, haha, screw you, I stole the horses, it does not matter how small that transgression is. The PCs are murder hobos, in my opinion. And it's after 20 years of GMing.
Yeah.
Now, the thing is when you're doing this, you're not playing specifically to the player characters. You're playing to the players.
Yeah.
For some strange reason, when the players sit down, they just turn into chaotic evil murder monkeys somehow.
Well, it's whenever they have dice to roll.
And yeah, whenever they have dice to roll. So it really doesn't matter. And I've had the NPC in question that I use as an example here is Njal, who was a dark elf bard. In this actual world that you guys are in now, in a previous incarnation.
Okay.
And she was part of a group called the Sinister Six. Really comic booky, I know. And the Sinister Six were designed to beat the crap out of the party. Every base was covered.
And that was mainly just to keep them sort of in line, or just as a, this is going to happen because
story? It was a two-part thing. Number one, they were running ramshot over the campaign. And believed that nothing could harm them.
So you had to humble them.
So I had to humble them, and there's also the thing called causality.
Mm-hmm.
The bigger you are, the more big the enemies that are attracted to you will get.
It's kind of like in comic books, the bigger the threat they defeat, the next figure has to be even bigger.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of that thing of like a lot of stories, it's like, oh, this guy slayed a god and blah, blah, blah. Well, how do you get any bigger than that? What, do you make a double god?
Double god. Njal, she was part of the Sinister Six, came in and they humiliated and humbled the party immensely and had them tossed into a dungeon. Now here's where, of course, I say playing the players. And this was like the first incarnation, so I was not expecting the players to be fucktards about it. She was the only one out of the Sinister Six who developed morals and realized that they were there to remove the party because the evil bad guy that they were harshing on the entire time had bigger plans that would invade on her comfort level. So she was still kind of a little bit evil, but she knew that the player characters were the only chance to help.
Yeah.
So she risks her life, gets mortally wounded, and again, this is when I was still a newer GM, so it was my mistake as putting her as a linchpin on the story. I did not expect the player characters to act the way they did at that time, and now, yeah, whatever. So, after risking life and limb, she rescues them, has them healed up, has them treated, takes care of them, but she's mortally wounded and dying.
Yeah.
Not even the lawful good cleric would bring themselves to cast a heal spell on her or treat wounds.
Mm-hmm.
But the information they needed to continue the story was still in her head.
Mm-hmm.
And the wizard was like, well, give me a couple of levels for necromancy. I'll carry her skull around and we'll just ask the ghost after she's dead. So basically they were just like, fuck that bitch, even though she was pivotal to the storyline.
Yeah.
And to his credit, Adam, one of my other players, in a later incarnation of this setting,
mm-hmm.
Niall got morphed into a new character because it didn't work out in the world as well. And she also betrayed the player characters.
Mm-hmm.
But this time, because she was being manipulated by other people and believed that the player characters were going to be part of a larger bad thing going on for the kingdom. And, of course, when she reappears, she's cut up, she's scarred, she's gone through hell in a handbasket, and the player characters are like, everybody at the table is like, fuck that bitch. And Adam is, like, playing a paladin. And he's just sitting across from the room glaring at me.
Mm-hmm.
He's not glaring at me being the character. Because even when I shuff off and I'm, like, doing descriptive background stuff, he's glaring in my direction, obviously. And the only reason he gave her reason or opening to talk is because he was a paladin.
Yeah.
So revenge is a great motivator. And whenever you pull revenge, you're playing to the players, not the characters.
Yeah.
So any betrayal, no matter how small, if you steal a horse, somehow, hell and high water, the player characters will find a way to make that NPC's life hell. I don't know why, but players tend to take it personal when there's betrayal, even if their character would be like, shit happens. Even if they're playing true neutral, I've seen it where they're like, fuck that motherfucker. He threw a rock at my hireling. So one of the motivators that will get players to go through the rest of the storyline by hell or high water
mm-hmm.
is a little bit of betrayal. It doesn't, and it's weird because it doesn't even need to be a large betrayal. It can be small.
Yeah.
You can burn their base of operations down.
You can steal their horse.
You can steal their horse. It can be a completely replaceable thing. But for some reason, it's just the fact of the matter that they were betrayed, and they will just go fuck shit crazy. So there's one motivator you can use, whether you're GMing on the other end of this podcast or you're the GM in this room.
Well, here's the one I'm using, just to give an example and let cue people in. So in this world, there's the guilds, which are where the major core classes, because I'm starting just the main three books, Bestiary, GM,
Player's Handbook,
and Player.
Yep, and GM's Guide.
You know, those are my only books I'm allowing to be used. Core races, core backgrounds, all that stuff, because I'm really new to this. So each one of the main classes in the core rulebook are either tandem in a guild, or they're their own guild, which has allowed me to boil it down to 7 guilds, so I can never have more than 7 people, because each guild only gets 1 representative per party group. The hierarchy here, after having seen the signs and an ominous building appears in the Badlands, which is connected to an ancient great evil trying to return.
Oh, the MacGuffin.
They decide to send out several groups of adventurers to try and track down these 30-some-odd items that they'll need to slay this evil again. They decide to try and fill in the groups. Now we had a problem of I didn't want to run 7 people because I new to this, so I made it so that the groups are tandem together, and because of a war that happened a decade prior to the events of our game, there is a bit of a manpower shortage. You know, this was a great war, it cost hundreds of thousands of lives on both sides, and population wasn't that big in the first place, so there's not full adventuring parties of 7 in every group, and we're group 9 out of, like, I think there's going to be 15 or 16 parties. So we have good representation, good way to have people not double up on what they are. So we have a good, well-rounded group.
Mm-hmm.
So we have the bard, which is my character, to try and get people going. We've got a barbarian, which is the Fatimus himself.
Fatimus himself is playing the dumb jock barbarian.
Who wants to sleep with everything.
We're going to get along so great.
As
long as he doesn't fuck my sister.
That's between your companion and him.
Okay.
Goblin here is playing our resident sorcerer.
Sorcerer, yep. The extraordinaire opener of doors and panties.
Yes.
Because that's how I do it. If you need information, I will find you information. Because fuck that bitch, this is Vosk.
Of course, Izuri Riz is our Russian elf. He's a bard. He survived the war, and now he is high enough to be the representative of the council. He is the one leading this party, but he doesn't like to get his hands dirty, so he will allow them many leeways.
We have Nedge playing possibly our rogue.
She's leaning heavily towards rogue right now. It would be Granny Smith, the rogue.
Yeah. We've got Narciss, who will be playing our...
Cleric?
Cleric, yes.
Of whatever god I don't know yet.
He has to get back to me still.
Mm.
And then we let Kazarkan... Well, I let Kazarkan in. I'm still a little shaky on the number
of people. He listens to these podcasts, right?
Oh, yeah. So I'm trying to work out how to balance all this in the creatures we're going to fight and all that. But he's coming in as our druid. And then you have a follower who's going to pick up the last slot for representing the groups.
I figure my follower is going to be more window dressing. And that's one of the things, that we're going to do in the more advanced, I guess, Goblins gaming corner is, NPCs and their roles in the party. But for now, my follower, I believe, is going to be more window dressing than actually involved in the adventure itself.
True. But it gives me a way to fill in a slot of we trying to have 7 represented from each guild.
Mm.
And having people in. And it's... I wanted to just do 4 originally, and then Kazakhstan was our final ad because it's an invite-only game. And I believe since Goblin here is going to have a follower, I can say we have a representative from each by having to pigeonhole your follower into being a monk. Or at least...
Okay, fine. My follower will be a monk.
Yes.
Okay, fine. The arguments my character and his first follower will have due to alignment restrictions will be hilarious.
Yes.
So, keeping in line with the theme of this Goblin's Gaming Corner, as you've dubbed it, what is our motivation? Since we're going to be new characters at the table, and we want to motivate new players and new characters, what is our motivation? What's that hooked, bright drag us right into your game?
Well, one is to fight this evil, but that's more of what the Grand Empire wishes to do, because they're directly threatened, because this ancient evil once ruled the good portion of the land that is the Empire of Vosk. So they want to keep that from happening. They like their power. But you guys are all representatives of the guild. You're level 7. You're journeymen, basically, in your guild. So you're able to do your things, but here, adventuring parties can't just be adventuring parties. There have to be forms filled out because they don't want the countryside to be full of chaos, and they don't want their... They have a hard time with having adventurers out, even though it's a nation that was founded by adventurers in centuries past.
Okay, so we're going with the prime items here that's a storyline, so we're probably going to get some storyline reward out of it.
Oh, yes.
Whether it be lands, titles, or something that we just write down on our paperwork says, I am now connected to Duke Nukem of the ICBM network of guilds. So we might get a contact out of it. Mm-hmm. And of course, you said we're going to be able to buy the deal. And the other player's going to find out about this anyway in game session 1, so it's not a spoiler. Is that anything we find inside the dungeons,
yes,
other than the item MacGuffins we're looking for, we get to keep?
Basically, the Empire is pretty well off when it comes to funds. They're not in a financial struggle. So they don't care about anything else. They want to get rid of this evil. So they want the key of the 33 items. They want that. They want one of those items. So there's at least 30 dungeons to go and hunt through. And they want the key item out of each. That's all they care about. If there's gold, whatever it just means they don't have to pay them any extra.
So what per... Okay, let me take a long pause here while I usurp you for a second. Mm-hmm. What is our motivation beyond that?
Beyond simply getting paid.
What is going to grab us? Because you said we're going to have to write little backgrounds, and you've gotten a little bit of my background, even though it hasn't been written down and solidified yet. What is it that you're going to grab the player with? Because you're not playing, as a GM, you're not running a game for the characters, you're running a game for the players. you've also got to find a way to hook the players in, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, a few of you are going to have direct threats to your well-being and your placement. Some of you will have already run into people in your lives that have become servants of this evil person, this evil entity that is trying to return. And some of you honestly simply see it as a way to move up in your guild, because that's the big hard part right now is a lot of your guilds are at the point where they need younger, fresher faces, and there's a whole lot of apprentices out there, but there's not a lot of ability for them to move up because the older people that are there don't want to move. And if you guys move up in rank in your guilds, you achieve more power, you achieve lands. Some of you might move into the House of Lords, because that is the ruling class, really. They are the aristocrats.
To give an example, and that's a really good route to go right there, what I mean by playing to the player and hugging the player in, I'm going to use Thoric as an example. Mm-hmm. If I was running a true horror campaign, which is really difficult, it's one of the hardest kind of games to run, because you want to give the players that weird feeling that crawls up their spine. And there's a lot of little tricks that you have to pull off camera that the players don't even realize.
Mm-hmm.
Such as turning the temperature on the thermostat down just enough to make the room uncomfortable so people have to bundle up and sit like this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hugging themselves because the temperature is down but it's not uncomfortable. It's just barely noticeable. But if I wanted to play to Thoric, and I can describe in a horror campaign a scene of ghoulish slaughter where a child has been just disemboweled and thrown across the room, I can go into detail about this for 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And I can have half the players in my party be heartless bastards who've seen every horror movie imaginable, and they won't care.
Mm-hmm.
They will not give a shit. And Thor can be sitting there, and he's heard some pretty horrible things come out of my mouth in the past. He can be just like, oh, he's just playing this character. Now, but if I want to just nab him that little bit, I see there's a chill breeze in the air, and it cuts through your clothing ever so slightly and feels like thousands of spiders crawling across your skin.
Mm-hmm.
Because he has a phobia of spiders, describing the feeling of a thousand spiders crawling across his skin underneath a light breeze will fuck with him.
Yes.
So that's what you got to do with your players, regardless of the scene or setting or genre you're playing, is find that little hook that really gets him. Darth Narsis is obviously a very greedy person, and he's a power gamer who likes numbers. So if you dangle a few numbers in front of him, he will go after that like a junkyard dog. And if you hit him where it hurts, which is by the stats on his character sheet, he will feel the pain more so than his character taking 100 hit points of damage from a single blow.
Yeah.
So that's one thing to remember when you're doing as a GM, is you're playing to the players, not the characters.
Okay.
I mean, of course, it's all about the characters. The characters are supposed to be the ones in the spotlight. But when you really want to drive a nail home, hit the player, not the character.
So I've known all you guys for a good while.
Yeah.
And you guys are my friends outside of podcast and game. I mean, to do that, I could probably come up with a few things, but I just figured as just a first time, as this originally started as the idea for a one-off, just let's go run a dungeon.
Well, I'm kind of giving you a little bit of advanced ideas right now.
Yeah, which will definitely help for me to keep it so that after, say, God forbid, we actually finish all the dungeons and find the things and the big battle's coming, a way to motivate them to want to be the people doing the battle.
Yeah. That's predominantly it. You want to motivate the players to be the ones to be in the spotlight.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, you're setting it up really simplistic, which is a good idea. You don't really have to worry about more of the advanced ideas, just yet the advanced techniques. Like any other thing that you do, whether it's car detailing, which is essentially cleaning a car out, but woodworking, it doesn't matter. Metalworking, sculpture, you start small.
Mm-hmm.
You don't try to make the next Venus de Milo right out of the gate. You're going to sit around and fuck around with clay for a few years first.
Yeah.
GMing is the same way. You're not going to start out with the ultra epic dungeon game one. And if you try, you will fail.
Oh, yeah.
There's that. So you're starting out. 33 dungeons does sound like quite a bit, but
well, you guys aren't going to be doing all 33.
Yeah, well, you're also doing mini dungeons, too.
There are mini dungeons. They're not all, you know, giant, elaborate underground cities where you have to traverse the volcano to find the special conch that summons the sea turtle that can swim in lava to transport you to the Eldritch Horror level to get the one map and key to get back into the lower level to summon the goddess.
Excuse me, that's my game, and you guys have yet to summon the goddess.
No, actually, I stole most of that little bit from Loading Ready Run, who have really been another key inspiration for me. Because they, a couple years ago, I think it was 2015 or so, did a Temple of the Lava Bears run. When 5e first came out, they were playtesters, because they're in with Wizards really well, because they do a lot of stuff. And it really inspired me to want to play a game, because that was before you had invited me into anything, and I was just picking up DMing, partially due to other life things, but partially because I saw it was where a lot of my friends were going with things. Like, I played Fatty's MX for a while.
Yeah.
I really just enjoy role-playing because it lets me use my imagination, and it made me want to get into one of these campaigns where there's fantasy and it's, you know, kind of in-depth, and I wanted my end goal to one day become a GM, and I figure, why not just try it out with people I trust? That way I'm not getting burned by some random person at a shop or something being like, sure, I'll play your game and break the shit out of it.
That is actually a wise choice to make before you even run your first game.
Mm-hmm.
So congratulations, kudos there. I give you a gold star for that one. A 5-pointy gold star, not 6. I'm being nice today.
Is it right side up or upside down?
It's right side up. Well, I don't know.
Is one of them longer than the rest?
It's a pinwheel.
Pinwheel?
Pinwheel. Okay, so you've watched a lot of videos lately. I think you said you watched, what, 80 hours worth of videos or some shit in the last few
about
weeks?
About 40 to 60. Okay. Some of it was just going back and watching games. Some of them were, like, I'd highly recommend A Fistful of Dice. I really like their channel. They go over several things. They talk about classes and stuff. They talk about how to play every class they seem to like to talk about. They talk about alignments, which I found really helpful there. My character in your campaign right now is an occultist, as I mentioned before. Human. Only human in the party. And he is chaotic good. And their thing really backed up what chaotic good means. And I figure with Goblins Gaming Corner, you will do a lot more on the alignments and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
So, which I figure just gives you carte blanche to just record those and throw them up whenever you like.
Dude, the amount of shit, if I recorded the audio of what's going through my head while I'm on autopilot at work, oh my god, the amount of audio I'd be able to put out, I'd be able to do an episode a day just on this stuff.
But, well, now you've got the freedom to do it. Just record when you feel like it and upload.
I don't wanna. I'm lazy. Okay, anyway.
So,
the videos you watched. And you said, you know, that's a lot of hours. What questions are still burning in your head that I can answer within the next 30 minutes?
So, one thing I'm struggling with, and you had already given me a little advice on this, is there's a specific monster I want to put in the beginning of the dungeon. Just to be like, these adventurers were a little smart and put something that would ward most people off and possibly pass them away with, or give them something that they think is the prize, but really isn't. There's basically there's a facade that you guys have to be able to see through, but I wanted the first room in the dungeon, and yes, you're going to have meta-knowledge.
I've already got tons of meta-knowledge on this.
So, would be, I want the first room to have this one creature, and getting challenge rating off the bestiary. First time I've actually looked through the bestiary was this weekend. Basically, what I would want to use would be considered a boss monster for people at our level. But how would you take something, like, if you wanted something really specific, just mainly for flavor reasons, and then to make it so that could be a monster they fight without it being the final boss monster, because you've already got the boss monster part figured out,
mm-hmm.
Making it so that these are kind of like, we can punch through these just fine. And, you know, basically, how to fudge it? Do you just straight up fudge the rolls, or do you take some aspects of the creature's baseline and dumb them down? Maybe half it, or, you know, slow their assault.
Just slow their assault. Okay, one of the things that, and I've been doing this in my campaign without telling you guys, and I've done it in other campaigns, is you'll have essentially what's called fluff fights.
Mm-hmm.
They're fights that there is no possible way the players can fail.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but what is important about these fights is for you as a GM, is you're not actually challenging the players at these points. You're just throwing fluff on the table and letting the players swing their swords around and get their murder on, and maybe sit down in their dwarven circle jerk and touch one another. the real important part about these fights is behind the GM screen, what you're doing is you're taking notes.
Mm-hmm.
Whose attack is the most powerful? Who has the most AoE attack power?
Mm-hmm.
Whose saves are the highest in the mental area?
Mm-hmm.
You're basically taking notes about the player characters, and even though you have all of their numbers, if you're taking notes about the character sheets when you ask them to hand over character sheets, and you're taking down their AC and their hit points and stuff, so you have the stuff on your GM's record, what you're looking for more or less in this point, and again, this is a GM playing to the players, not the characters,
mm-hmm.
is you're finding out how the players react to the combat situation, because you're always going to have somebody who's more inclined towards strategy.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have the one guy who wants to be a rogue and glory all the goddamn combat.
Mm-hmm.
You're finding out the group dynamics of how they fight and work together.
Yeah.
If you're lucky enough to have a group that works together. And heaven forbid, you do get a group that works together.
Which is what I'm kind of hoping for. But I doubt it.
You're hoping for it, but if you get a group that works together, they are near unstoppable.
Mm-hmm.
When you actually get a collective doing a power meeting off to the side, and they're like, here's how we approach this battle.
Mm-hmm.
And I need you here, I need you here, I need you to pull your resources to this.
Yeah, I need the so-and-so to cast mage armor on blah.
Especially if you get somebody who's really good at strategy or working the game without having to work the numbers. They're just fucking creative as shit. What you're doing as a GM in these fluff battles is figuring out how this dynamic works.
Mm-hmm.
So when you do bring a challenge in later on, it's supposed to mess with the party and actually provide a challenge. It meets the challenge by focusing on fighting the players and their dynamic of fighting, so the player has to change their shit around real quick,
mm-hmm.
or they're going to lose. So if you have the rogue running around, stabbing the fuck out of everything in the back, and being like Mr. Glory Hog, while the rest of the party is actually twirling and working together, well, you're going to have a creature that has an ability that, say, it splits off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a critical strike the main party makes against a creature has a clone split off, and that clone goes beeline for the rogue with all the same powers and abilities that the main has.
Yeah.
Which means that the main party, who's turtling now, they could take on both of those creatures at the same time. It still pretty much hold true. But now you have the party taking on one creature and the rogue taking on another creature that's got the same powers and abilities.
Mm-hmm.
So that glory hog is now really screwed because he keeps moving away from the rest of the party.
Yeah.
You're not punishing him, you're providing a challenge, hopefully. You want to provide these creatures to the rest of the group that are more or less, hey, we're here to be two-dimensional cardboard cutouts and die, but make you think there's a challenge.
Yes.
And in this case, I would say reduce all my roles as a GM
mm-hmm.
by, say, 3.
Okay.
If, it say, the group is level 7 and you have a challenge rating 7 creature out of the book, so as far as Pathfinder, Dungeons & Dragons 3.0, 3.x, 3.5... and so on and so on and so forth. For those who are not familiar with this setting, a party of 4 people equivalents to a CR7 challenge. So one CR7 creature should provide a challenge to that party and probably knock them down about halfway of their resources and or life hit points. So in this case, you want little cardboard cutouts. I would reduce the dice rolls on all of their stats and abilities and attributes.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, a CR7, you want it to be more of a CR3.5 encounter. I would go with the -3, -5 range.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the big, if they're intelligent creatures, the big leader of them would be the lowest negative denominator, while his chumps would be more around the -5 mark.
Okay.
I would reduce it. Or, of course, you have caveat as a GM to say, oh, this isn't working, and just start fudging it.
Mm-hmm.
However, I as a GM, and almost any GM, whether old or new, one thing that you have to develop with your players is trust.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that has my players always trust me at the table, for the most part, is I will go let the dice fall where they may.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a critical role and we're in the middle of combat,
and you're about to ghost someone,
and I'm about to do something crazy, you know, the creature could be doing the last attack that could end in a TPW. Total party wipe.
Mm-hmm.
I will reach across over on the other side of my DM screen and just drop that D20 in front of everybody and say, I'm sorry. It hits. There is no denying what that dice rolled if everybody watches me roll it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and even when I'm rolling it behind the screen, I'm not making shit up.
Yeah.
And pretty much, you guys know that I have no poker face whatsoever. So when I look up and I'm like, ooh, I'm sorry. You know I rolled really well.
Mm-hmm.
There's no bones about it. So I try to develop some semblance of trust, because I, as a GM, I do not go out of my way to kill player characters.
Mm-hmm.
That's not my job. My job is to provide a challenge. My job is to provide a fun experience. If everybody's having fun, I'm doing my job right. That's pretty much it in a nutshell. So when you're creating these monsters as fluff monsters and you want them to be out there and scare us,
mm-hmm.
that's all right. You know, seven of these creatures come out. They're all CR7 each. Holy shit, that should scare players.
Mm-hmm.
That's a hell of a challenge. But you as a GM don't have to tell us what negatives you're giving to them.
Okay.
Because your job is to provide a fun experience to the players.
Mm-hmm.
A challenge. Nothing more. Now, unless we get, you know, total super douchey and I turn into a jackass and I'm totally glory-hugging the spotlight and everything, fucking flaming boulders from the sky, that's all you need.
Well, at this point, it'd be collapsing floors.
Or collapsing floors.
I find that to be a little more fun, because you will always find something that someone's standing on. You collapse into a giant pit, well, they die.
And as far as this is concerned, actually, this is something I was thinking about at work just 2 days ago. I pulled a story where the party heard about a black dragon
mm-hmm.
that was terrorizing the local township. The township needed help, and of course, they were all so much in fear that they wouldn't come out and talk to the party characters, and the party characters, of course, needed to talk to the leadership of the said town to continue said story.
Okay.
Okay, so they need to take care of the dragon so they can continue the quest.
Yeah.
And of course, this is at a time and point when the group is after dragons, because everybody wants dragon armor, because it's the in thing to wear that season, apparently, for adventurers. And this is one thing that you have complete gratis over, the same thing I did. The group gets out there, they expect a black dragon.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it was a black dragon, and I'm doing air quotes here now, dick fingers. The black dragon, I had swapped out its breath weapon for a blue dragon's breath weapon, and its resistances with a red dragon. Because one thing that's really bothered me is always color-coded dragons.
Yeah.
So they went out there expecting acid attacks. Boy, did they get a surprise when it did a breath weapon into the water that they were standing on. And they were like, fuck. Well, and then they go, oh, black dragon, we'll just hit it with this energy type because it has crappy resistances to it, and it just laughs as the fireball just bounces off of its scales. And you're like, the fuck?
Mm-hmm.
You have complete gratis to do anything you want to the monsters to keep people on their toes, or to just let them have a good day. There are dozens of different variants of standard monsters. You've got the reassembling skeletons, you've got the undying skeletons, you've got the skeletons that merge in the middle of combat. There are a shitload of different skeleton and zombie types.
Mm-hmm.
And you as the GM can pull out of your ass a new monster on a whim.
Mm-hmm.
You can mix and match. And for the most part, as long as you remember to keep that monster's power level in check with your group's power level,
mm-hmm.
to not overdo it,
yeah.
then you're doing all right. So if you want to drop these monsters in and have them basically be nothing more than the speed bump,
mm-hmm.
that is your full right. And, the rules, as they stand, like I was saying earlier today before we were going to Taco Bell, that is not an endorsement for Taco Bell, and it also is. Yes.
Eh.
Whatever. Anyway, the group that I was doing with you guys in it, I told you I was ramping their numbers up, and that's because I had more than four players across the board, and the way the book is written is for four players at the table. So for every player extra at the table, I would just ramp up those numbers by 25%, roughly.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I have to accommodate for people with giant beat sticks. So I had ramped it up just ever so slightly a little bit more. But it's turned out to be kind of a challenge for you guys so far.
Yeah.
Especially with those damage shields.
Oh.
And this is the shit I've been doing as a GM behind the scenes. I'm not making the creatures outright too brutal. Even the custom-built guy.
Oh, yeah. That was fun.
That was fun. It took you 2 days to take that guy down, but he was a challenge, not a player killer.
Well, technically it took us a month because we had to keep missing days, but hey, real life.
Yeah, real life.
So,
any GM, you or anybody listening to this podcast, you're not the guy, you're not God.
Yeah.
Okay? You're not God, but you tell God what to do.
Mm-hmm.
If you want flaming cows from the sky, do it. But just keep in mind, anybody who's listening to this podcast, your job as a GM is to provide a fun and interesting experience. Not to give in to the temptation in every one of us GMs. You will too.
Mm-hmm.
will get the temptation to become antagonistic towards the players.
Yeah.
There are players who sit down at the table and see the GM as the final boss of the game.
Mm-hmm.
The GM is the challenge.
Yeah.
Which is completely untrue, but there are people like that.
Mm-hmm.
And if you fall into that trap and become an antagonistic GM and you're no longer having fun as a GM, it's time to put the dice down.
Yeah.
It's done at that point.
Well, that's definitely something to take into consideration. Now, a fun thing is I've heard many different ways of doing this is putting a puzzle. You know, I've seen many videos where they're like, puzzles are great, but you got to watch out for this, or if someone's playing this class, you got to kind of build towards that. Or you were saying that sometimes it just comes down to someone's role, where it's like, they just know this puzzle, so bam. So I've made a custom puzzle, which I'm not going to go over the specifics, but it's something I made up because I can't seem to find it.
Because I'm really getting tired of all this meta knowledge.
Yeah.
Keep this up and I'm just going to play a fucking stick with a hat on it.
Well, I have few people to turn to because both you and Fatty are in, and like my only other person to talk to might have been, one of the guys at the shop who's running a game at the shop. I was going to run stuff by him, but I hardly see him. I don't have many avenues to turn to talk to people about how to GM because both of you guys are in the campaign. So luckily you and Fatty both said, hey, you know, we keep that knowledge out.
Fatimus does strike me as more of a mature GM, and I think he could really do some cool shit if he had a more mature audience.
Yeah.
The audience that he attracts right now, and he's got certain rules. Every GM has rules, and he's a lot more loosey-goosey about who jumps in and out of his games, obviously. I
mean, mm-hmm.
The MX crowd can be three people one week and nearly half a dozen the next, and one person the next week, and then two dozen the week after that, so.
Yeah.
He's kind of willy-nilly about that, and I'm more reserved. But yeah, Fatty strikes me as the kind of guy who would definitely not try to overextend his bounds as a GM or as a player.
Going to the puzzle thing, what are your thoughts, really, on having a puzzle for the party to figure out? Because I know we had one, but luckily we had an NPC who could solve it. And I don't really remember any other puzzles in the few bits we've been through with you.
Puzzles are problematic.
Okay.
Either they are too hard,
mm-hmm.
or they are too easy, or they are too common, or not common enough. Puzzles have a really hard medium to hit. And some puzzles that I've seen are really clever, and one I kind of want to rip off, but people would get it right away, would be the mirror chamber, where the puzzle, basically there's a long hallway, and you have to stare in a mirror and walk backwards through it.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you try to go the other way, you'll just get disintegrated.
Gotcha.
Yeah. That's actually one that I wanted to steal, but it's from pop culture, and anybody who's watched the D&D movie would call me out on it real quick.
Oh, don't worry. In my game, the head of the Brotherhood of the Snake, which is the Monk's Guild.
Yeah.
He is Master Ken.
But I do love Lux from that movie. That barbarian babe should star in more movies because I want to see her again.
Which D&D movie
was that? That was the one where it was all about Jublex. It was really hilarious. They were showing it on Sci-Fi, and during one of the commercials, they were like, D&D rule number 4, never let the cleric die.
Yeah.
And what happens in the next 15 minutes? The cleric gets eaten by a white dragon. I am like, that's awesome. It's like the D&D rule just got broken on purpose or some shit.
It's one of those self-aware movies.
Very self-aware. However, they are an issue.
Because they're very hit and miss. It's a very fine line is what you're telling me of how to get a puzzle just right to where it's not overly obvious to anyone, or at least it's a little hard for them to metagame it, or it's not to the point where you basically need, you know, foreknowledge that only the GM knows.
It's as if you guys come to a room and I give you a riddle, and you have to solve the riddle to get through that room, and I give you a classic.
Mm-hmm.
Most younger crowd would get it nowadays thanks to popular media, but when I started gaming, nobody would get it unless they were a neckbeard. And that would be the I have a box in no corners, no keyhole, no lid riddle.
From Lord of the Rings.
From Lord of the Rings. If I'm doing a brand new group and other people have seen that movie, then they will sit there and they will be like just shouting answers out left and right. And if somebody hadn't seen that movie, they'd be like, ah, that's an egg, fuck you.
Yeah.
Riddle solved. See, so it's either too easy or too hard. It's really hard to find that medium in between, and you have players who are actually intelligent enough to realize that the character may have an intelligence score that's higher than them.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm playing, let's say, a wizard with a decent intelligence rating of 14.
Mm-hmm.
That means, according to according to loose mathematics, that's about 140 IQ.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the average person will be more close to the 110 range.
Okay.
This means that the wizard has 30 IQ points on the average gamer, usually. Well, the average gamer actually might have a slightly higher IQ than that, but still, regardless of the point.
Baseline from population.
Baseline from population is about 110.
From the normies.
From the normies. So,
praise God.
If I got the wizard, the player sitting there playing the wizard, and he's trying to solve the riddle, and he hasn't seen Lord of the Rings, and he doesn't know it's an egg, everybody's shouting words around, he may actually have the actual player intellect and acumen and wisdom to go, I can make a roll with my character.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do a puzzle like that. You can do a riddle or some weird Sudoku puzzle or whatever, and you can have the intelligence-based caster go, well, I'm going to make a roll.
Yeah.
Or if the puzzle happens to be a dexterity-based one that the rogue has to solve, the rogue goes, I make a tumble check. A player who keeps in mind that their character is better than they are physically or mentally or in a charisma sort of way can just defeat your riddle with a simple die roll.
Yeah, but when it's a physical, you know, big block puzzle, you know, or something more than just the intelligence base to know how to do it, how does that kind of play in? Like, say it's a...
Well, with the one that you're building right now, if I were to try to defeat it, it would be trial and error.
Okay.
Basically, I would go in with a bag of weighted sand, Indiana Jones that shit.
True. Well, I'm trying to work in a...
Or better yet, because of the way my character's built, is I would just wait on the other side of the room for everybody else to catch up while I take a nap.
Mm-hmm.
Because... Fuck, man. Pillars and on a floor? Fuck this. I'll just pull out my flying pillow. Fuck you all. Still.
Well, I built something into it so that...
But if I was a ground pounder, if I was stuck on ground, I would actually do it... kind of like when you're trying to rescue somebody from quicksand and you would get a human chain.
Mm-hmm.
I would send one person out, calculate the results, they start figuring it out on a piece of paper... Have the next person follow up and stand where the first person went, let the first person go out a little bit further, and just chain our way across like that until we get to the end.
Okay.
So basically, we did the intellectual form of a human chain.
Okay.
That's how I would go about it. But I'm not playing the intelligence character in this group, so neener.
So that's definitely one way to look at it. So puzzles and monsters are two of the basic parts of a dungeon. They're the cornerstones, really, because you want them
puzzles, monsters, and traps.
Traps is the next one I was going to.
Okay.
So with traps, you know, I've read a bit on it, and I've listened to a few things, but it's not sinking in. I've also been fighting a migraine for a week, so.
Yeah.
And it's back today. So what would be, good ways to throw in traps? Just pick a square and have it be, like, trap, key point, box text on trap.
Okay, traps are going to have... a few variable vectors, and they cover this in the GM's books and stuff. One of them is, how does the trap go off? What's the trigger? What is the trigger? What is the range of effect? What does the trap do? You've got some very simple basics. The most devastating trap I ever did had no trigger.
Mm-hmm.
It had no range of effect. And it just killed people.
Was this your Orb of Destruction?
Yes, yes, yes. This is when I put an Orb of Annihilation underneath the floorboards.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my god, dude, you brought back that story.
Tell the story, please.
Okay. Every GM inevitably at some point will have their crown jewel. The one thing that people will talk about for years after to come, their old go-back to. And the two times I ran this particular dungeon, which I called the Dollhouse, which was a complete theme dungeon, the first time I ran it, the player characters burned the treasure. It was around 75,000 gold pieces of treasure in a chest. They poured oil on it, dropped in a match, and walked away. That's how done with the dungeon they were. The second group, which Thoric was in, they got to the halfway point in the dungeon, By the time they got there, the rogue was halfway through picking the lock, and he looks through the keyhole, sees what's on the inside. He's like, fuck this, I'm out. And walks. And the rest of the party's like, well, the rogue's going, well, shit. And they walked. They got halfway through before they walked. They were defeated. Both groups were defeated by a level 1 awakened construct with a backpack full of scrolls.
And which appears in our game?
Which appears in your game.
Ah, yes, Grumpy.
But the trap that was in this particular house, and I don't know why, the guy playing the barbarian had a thing for double doors. He just had to knock them off their hinges.
Mm-hmm.
And the first time they get to the outside of the house, and like any standard building, they've got their portcullis, and this particular keep had the portcullis on the other side of the gate. So they could drop the doors, and so when somebody came up to try to ram the building, the doors would bounce off the portcullis. So the portcullis was providing support for the doors to prevent ramming entry. Well, the barbarian, he runs up, and he makes this killer fucking swing. He nails the die roll, jumps up in the air, he swings his two-handed greatsword around, slams against the door, and the roll was just so phenomenal, I had to give it to him. So he hits the door, the old rusted hinges pop out of their joints. The door, from the force of the kinetic impact, lifts up ever so slightly, about a quarter inch off the ground, and then slams back down and leans against the portcullis. Like 800 pounds of wood, leaning against the portcullis, sealing that entrance.
Mm.
They couldn't get in that way. He sealed the entrance to the fucking dungeon. So as a GM caveat, I had to make some shit up on the fly, and there have to be a secret entrance through a false water well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's one thing you might have to do as a GM. Now you know it. Is you'll have to make some shit up.
Yeah.
On the fly. So the group gets in through the newly discovered and newly invented secret entrance that I had not planned to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
They get into the keep. They start walking down the main hallway. And down the other end of the hall is a pair of double doors. Oh my god, once again the barbarian, is like, aha, I can do this! And I look at my battle map as the GM, and I look at him, and I'm like, alright dude, what are you doing? Because it's a dead giveaway if I say, are you sure?
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, yep, I'm going for it. So he runs down the hall screaming, waving his sword over his head, jumps into the air, slams against the doors, makes a phenomenal goddamn roll.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I have to give it to him because he's made such a great roll. The doors bust off of their hinges, go flying into the room, slam down, and he comes in with this killer rock star, land on one knee, superhero drop through, like I'm ready for something, landing in the middle of the ballroom. The ballroom had 5 traps in it. They were all sound activated. So there's the trigger. They're all sound activated, and they all have a large radius of effect.
Mm-hmm.
So the barbarian lands in the room, and I have to make a series of rolls here. And I'm like, okay, make 5 reflex saves.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the traps actually were set up so that they would launch missiles and stuff, like fireballs, down hallways. So the rest of the group had to make a series of checks also.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the group, all they see is they're dodging down the side in the hallway on one side. There's this light show going on. It looks like a rave going on in the ballroom all of a sudden. And when they walk in there, there's this basically a charred slab of jerky going, what the fuck? He had set off all the traps in the room, so they were free to make noise or whatever. But the traps themselves had detonated, so the grandfather clock had exploded, the piano had shot wires all over the place at high velocity, and it was just a fucking mess. So here's where it comes down to the most deadly trap in this dungeon, apparently. They see yet a third pair of double doors. I shit you not. The barbarian is like, okay, I'm going to do this one, and if something bad happens this time, I am fucking done. No more. Okay. He's finally getting the hint not to run down the hall from the rest of the group screaming and charging at everything. He's finally getting the hint. So he's like, all right, I run down the halls. Rawr! I'm like, all right, make your roll.
Mm-hmm.
Reflex save. He's like, what? I'm just roll a reflex save. So he goes screaming down the hall. I'm like, everybody else gets to make a perception check, and they hear the barbarian, because it's a DC 3, basically.
Mm-hmm.
The barbarian goes running down the hall and then stops. He rolled a 2. on his reflex saving throw for a DC 5 trap.
And that's what his...
He had to roll 5 or higher on a reflex saving throw to avoid this trap.
Mm-hmm.
A level 1 character could have avoided it.
But just bad rolls.
Just a shit roll. So his character goes running down the hall and falls right through the illusionary floor right into a orb of annihilation.
Mm-hmm.
I take his character sheet and tear it up. There's nothing else I can do at that point. And one of the players actually decided to argue with me about this. He's like, well, that's not a trap that was for a dungeon of our level. I'm like, number one, the lore of this dungeon, as you know it in character, a great wizard lived here.
Mm-hmm.
Hence the word great wizard. National hero in the time that this land was part of an empire.
Mm-hmm.
So he's going to have access to some really neat shit. Number three, no wizard is going to be sitting down going, you know, I have a feeling a party of level 4 adventurers is going to come and try to steal my magical secrets. I should accommodate them and make sure that all the traps in my keep are equivalent to a level 4 challenge.
Mm-hmm.
So this great and powerful gnomish wizard never sat around going, you know, I think a group of level 6s are going to come walking through here. So I should make all the traps around level 6.
Mm-hmm.
No, he had an orb of annihilation. He's like, I'm going to stick it in this hallway in case anybody ever tries to break into this door from this side of my house.
A one-off one-of.
It was a one-off one-of. He just stuck it in there, cast illusionary terrain over it to create a permanent effect that looked like floorboards. Loosely tacked a carpet over it and called it good. But the thing is the trap was so crudely built. It was designed that if you break in from the outside and come in, that you wouldn't notice it because you'd be too busy trying to storm your way in.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it was a DC 5. It was a very crude trap. You could see it from 10 feet away and go, well, that doesn't look right. But since the barbarian is running at full charge in a dark hallway... So, yes. That's what happened. Thoric almost fell into one of the most obvious fucking traps in this place while we're on the tangent of traps. And if it wasn't for one of the other players in the group tying a rope around his waist, his character would have been fucking dead.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a simple trap, and if you could ever find them, and you're feeling very mischievous, look up Grimtooth's traps.
Okay.
These have a skull rating on them of how deadly they are. One or two skulls is usually a trap made for fun. 5 skulls means you just done your fucking group.
Okay.
One of them I pulled out of here was about a 3 skull. And honestly, the easiest way to disarm the trap is cast Detect Magic and go fuck this.
Mm-hmm.
What it involves is if you're drawing it out on a hex map, is you have the hallway is about 1 square by 20 squares. So mm-hmm. 5 feet wide by 20 times 5. About 100 feet long.
Mm-hmm.
Long hallway. The last square, couple of few squares in the room, the very, very last square is where there's a treasure chest sitting on the other side of an open pit.
Mm-hmm.
The treasure chest is sitting there, lids open, gleaming with jewels.
Yeah.
Woo! Stuff to get! Yay! The next square in front of that is a pit about 50 feet deep and lined with blades that are designed to keep people in.
Mm-hmm.
So the spikes are pointed downwards. So if you fall in, there's pretty much no way to get out. It's a pitcher plant trap. And then you got the hallway the rest of the way. Of course, the obvious solution would be to run, jump across the pit, land on the other side, and you start tossing the treasure back.
Yeah.
That would be the obvious solution. But that's where the trap comes into play, is that square, the line where it is. If you try to throw a rock across the chasm, you'll see the trap. If you cast Detect Magic, you'll see the trap.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't do this. This is why the dollhouse is so notorious, I guess. Also, thematically, the dollhouse, all the monsters in there were construct dolls with super abilities, like casting magic missiles, and when you run into a room with 20 of those little shits,
yeah,
they only cast one magic missile at 1d4, but there's 20 of them in there, so, and they're only one challenge rating 1/4.
Yeah.
But still.
They swarm.
They swarm. Yeah, the dollhouse scares people. Or you get, like, I had a bunch of dolls in there. We cast out burning hands.
Mm-hmm.
Just great sheets of fire across an entire room. They hated them. But this trap, the gnome, Jinx, actually, who's been resurrected, One of the other party members ties a rope around his waist, and he goes hauling ass, and he jumps across that little 5-foot chasm to reach the other side and get to the treasure chest. Well, that sets off the trap, which is a passive trap.
Okay.
All it is a wall. It's a wall of force.
Okay.
He basically just jumps face first at full speed into a force field, which means he runs forward and he goes, wham! Right into a basically an unbreakable window and slides down it and down into a pit. And took massive amounts of falling damage from the spikes, but he did not hit bottom because the rope stopped 5 feet short of the bottom where they had tied it off to. If they had tied it off a little bit more forward, they would have had a perforated gnome. But they did. They through time and effort, they managed to get him back out, and he was sore and angry. And they were like, screw it. And like one of the guys, after he jumps across, he just picks up a rock and he throws it, pink, right off the side and down the pit. And he's like, God damn it. Because it's a passive trap.
And
that's one of the other things, too, is make traps obvious.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea why, but if I make a trap obvious, for some reason, the players will fall into it every time.
Like, well, I still enjoy how I read your words.
Yeah. That's a trap that was also in the dollhouse, the Sepia Saint Sigil that was reincarnated.
Mm-hmm.
For that trap, somebody writes Sepia's name sigil in really, really, really super tiny letters in the middle of a paragraph. So as they're reading the paragraph, they don't even realize it until it's too late that they're reading Sepia's Snake Sigil in the middle of a paragraph. And of course, since it's really small letters, they got to lean super close to it. And then, boop, oh, you're fucked.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Dollhouse actually, Grumby has defended that place through two groups of characters. But as far as traps goes, one of them, and again, with players, when you're trying to play the player characters and stuff, one of the traps in the dollhouse, the great and powerful wizard was betrayed and created a bunch of cursed dolls, but had a change of heart. These were like master creations, but they were too dangerous to unleash on the world. So in the main foyer of his library, he had put them in glass cases magically and put them under normal mundane locks
and then cages, magical locks
and then magical glass cases on the outside of that, so you had two layers of locks to bust through. And there was a bunch of these dolls that he had made, but he had deemed that they were too dangerous to unleash on the world, and of course the group saw this as a challenge. And I don't know why, but the more difficult you make something, the more the group will want to do it. Basically, these glass cases might as well just had gleaming letters in front of it that says GM says no. But we can't let the GM say no, so they did everything they could to bust through these cases and get these dolls.
Yeah.
In that case, these dolls were indeed a trap. They saw a magical item, it radiated a magical aura, so they wanted it.
Yeah.
The trap trigger is taking possession of said doll because they're cursed. The curse only works on those who own the doll. And they actually got one to go off. There was one doll. It was basically nothing more than a decanter of endless water with no off switch.
See, I would know the ultimate way to market that. I'd be like, all right, what region is, you know, a desert-like region? Yeah. Let's take this doll and sell it to the big chieftain.
Exactly. But the doll had no off switch, and they were on a mountainside in the middle of winter. And so he would wake up in a pool of ice. One of the characters would wake up basically in slush in hypothermia mode. The cleric would have to like do heal spells to bring him out of hypothermia all the goddamn time. One of them that I was waiting to unleash was the Angry Swarm Doll.
Now, what'd that one do?
It continuously summoned a swarm of angry bees on whoever was nearest, which of course would be the owner.
Yeah.
There was another one that was the Mage's Helper, and I put Helper in quotations. It cast all the same spell that the if it was taken possession of by a caster, it would cast a duplicate spell that the caster cast at the same time at one half of all numerical values, which is pretty fucking balls when you think about it. Like. If I throw a fireball at 66 and the little doll is doing the exact same thing at 3d6, it's using all numerical values I'm using, but at half numbers. So, of course, the person's going to get a better saving throw because that second 3d6, but it's still pretty fucking balls.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is there's a 5% chance. So on a 1d20, the GM gets to roll whenever a spell is cast. If the GM rolls a nat 20, the doll turns on the caster and quadruples all numerical values.
Yeah.
So the caster throws his fireball at 66, and, you know, a saving throw is, we'll say, 14.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now it becomes 66 times 4, and that 14 times 4 for your saving throw. Suck it up, wizard.
Now, here's one I thought of when you told us this story the second time.
Oh, God. Yeah, I do.
That I wonder if you actually made. Basically, it's Stuffy Doll.
Stuffy Doll.
So, its owner gets, like, a natural armor boost, right?
Well, I don't know if I did a doll like that.
This one would be fun. It's basically Stuffy Doll. So,
yeah.
It has, like, something on it that makes it kind of hard to destroy. You know, well, it's a magic item. You have to use Mythic Shatter if you're going to try to destroy it, right? And it gives its owner a buff.
Yeah,
+1, +2, something small. And, you know, but they have to, like, have it on their person. So it means they're probably got, like, on...
Yeah.
In their bag or something. But if it ever gets hit by anything, it does that damage then to the person.
Yeah.
That would have been fun.
I know the one that I was waiting for, but unfortunately that group fell apart, is one of these dolls they wanted after. And I guess it wasn't even meant to be a trap, but just the way the players went after these dolls so hardcore, and I knew in the original design of the dungeon that these were cursed.
Mm-hmm.
And if they had progressed further down the dungeon and actually stopped to read the notes
mm-hmm.
that the wizard left behind, they would have known that the gnome had sealed these away so they would not wind up in the world in the open and cause harm. He had sealed them away on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't bother to read the notes. They were just like, fuck this, we're here for the loot.
Mm-hmm.
Player characters. Uh-huh. But one of them I was waiting to unleash, actually, the paladin god. And he'd chosen it because it was essentially nothing more than a doll that was Merlin's spoon. It created enough food to feed 4 people
mm-hmm.
for one day. But how to get the food is you actually had to rip the arms and legs off the doll. And when you did that, it would animate
mm-hmm.
and let out shrill, childlike screams that were hideously realistic and start twitching and screaming and bleeding and begging for help when you did it. I was waiting for the paladin to go, well, I got this doll that creates food. Let's activate it. And so they just, the mountainside echoes with shrill cries of terror. Because they realize, you know, they're tearing a bloody limb off of the doll. It tastes strangely like taffy. The dollhouse itself is my signature dungeon. And the traps in it, for the most part, are very obvious.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something to remember when you're doing traps, is they're going to have a trigger mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
And the trigger can be simple as when I step on a panel on the floor, the panel sinks a quarter of an inch,
mm-hmm.
and a blade pops out and cuts my ankle.
Okay. And
it tries to take my foot off. That would be a very simple, mundane one, whereas a magical one could be simply easy as I pass a certain vector, because magical things usually trigger when the area is invaded by something.
Yeah.
So your traps are going to be all over the place. For level 7, you're going to be a lot more mundane than magical traps.
Oh, yeah.
Magical traps are highly mischievous and devious, and depending on the kill factor you want to go with, if you want to scare the shit out of your players,
mm-hmm.
one of your magical traps could be simply they walk into a room,
mm-hmm.
the door slams shut behind them, and all 4 walls, the ceiling, and the floor all activate with a blade barrier,
mm-hmm.
which is a cleric spell,
mm-hmm.
which does something like 4d6 per round.
Mm-hmm.
And Blade Barrier lasts for, I think, 6 rounds base or something. I can't remember the spell stuff because I don't do clerics often.
Yeah.
But no matter where that player tries to go in there, they would die. Because the walls are serrated. The ceiling is serrated. The floor is serrated. It is all trying to kill them. It's basically like trying to be in the movie Cube.
Yeah.
But of course, every trap should have some way to defeat it.
Oh, of course.
Simply not take the doll out of the fucking case. Simply pay attention when you go down the hall instead of screaming like a maniac for the double doors. In the room, the case with the room with the blade barrier, you know, you open the door, you look in, there's a big empty room, which is a bit suspicious. You could throw a rock in, it'll set off the trap,
mm-hmm.
and when the door opens back up, throw in another rock and nothing happens because the trap only goes off once.
Yeah.
So a trap should have a way to defeat it. Because otherwise player characters, you know, if there's no way for them to defeat every challenge they meet, we'll get bored.
Well, I plan on making it. There's obvious defeatable ways and some things that are just relatively easy. Because remember, this was an adventuring party who did all this. So
yeah.
And the thing is, these used to be like their hideouts, their little spots. So it's not like these are, the wizard made it to keep this super powerful cock ring of fucking plus 30 sexual adeptness.
Ah, yeah. Yes, that is a treasured item my halfling wants so bad.
You know, it's not like he made a thing where a bunch of animated fucking, you know, double-ended dildos are trying to protect it and, you know, shit like that. It's one of those things where it's like, all right, these guys are just like, we got to hide these things. These places are already out of the way. No one really knows where they're at. And, you know, they made it a little more difficult. And one fun thing is some of them will be gotten by other parties.
Yeah.
And there are non-legitimate parties out there hunting these as well who are serving the Dark One. And there are some people who either went mad after they completed a dungeon and possibly killed everyone else in their party who didn't side with them, and are now running around trying to collect these things for their own power.
You don't need eyes to see where we're going.
Yes, yes, yes.
Okay.
But there's going to be a lot more. Like, these dungeons may end up being, when you walk through this one doorway, it's a magical portal, and now you're on a pocket plane where it's this, you know, giant wooded area that contains the thing, you know? Because remember, there was a wizard in the party.
Yeah.
Powerful one at that.
Well, as long as you don't pull the ring gate trap I did.
No.
But the whole house had a pair of ring gates in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was labeled laundry chute
mm-hmm.
on the second floor, which would make sense.
Mm-hmm.
You'd have a laundry chute on the second floor and go to the laundry room.
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, the laundry chute was a ring gate. And if you tried to go through the ring gate, you'd wind up about 50 miles offshore underwater.
Nice.
It's the little things.
See, I would have labeled it trash chute.
The trash chute would have worked too, but laundry chute, it's in more in line with the NPC for the dungeon. So we are pretty far into this, dude. You got a lot of editing to do, so any final words?
To anyone out there who is a new DM, I really hope this helps. It's helping me. To anyone who's an experienced DM and you have any advice, we do have ways to get a hold of us. Would you mind rattling those off real quick, Alvin?
We are at bfgamers@gmail.com. No, bfgamershq@gmail.com. You can also find us on Twitter. We have new followers on Twitter.
Really?
We do. And you can find us on Facebook. That's
mm-hmm.
where we first started. Our YouTube kind of sucks right now, so don't bother with that.
Well, that'll be starting up once we start these lovely videos.
Yes.
Camera coming soon.
Yeah, so you can find us on those variable vectors. And, of course, this podcast is hosted on podbean.com. So this is where you're going to find it.
True. But remember, if you want have any advice you want to give me, I am Darth Blasphemous. So title it towards me, and I'll be sure to take a look.
Yeah, feel free to zip us a message on any of our avenues, and our admin staff will take care of it.
Yeah, and then overall, I hope this helps people. It helps. If it inspires people, I hope they are inspired well. This is Darth Blasphemous signing off. We'll have a We Digress in the Chamber next week, where I pull a few fun parts from our first session, and then, of course, a little discussion along with it.
Yep, yep, yep.
Deuces.
And this is Goblin in the newly established, for some fucked up reason, Goblin's Gaming Corner. And remember, GMs, hit your players where it hurts, not the character sheet, but the players themselves. Not physically, just screw with their minds a little bit, and you'll have them roped in with a bit of motivation.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, peace!
Thank you for making it this far into the Blunt Force Gamers podcast. You're awesome for that. But now for the legal speak. Blunt Force Gamers is not funded or endorsed by any organization, and so the views and opinions expressed are solely our own. Music in this podcast is available on Incompetech.com and is used under the Creative Commons license. If you want royalty-free music for your own production, visit Incompetech.com. The music track in this podcast is Hitman, composed by Kevin MacLeod. To contact us, the Blunt Force Gamers, we can be emailed at bfgamershq@gmail.com. Thank you for listening, and see you next week.